So we have to put a radical trust in our clients. So it's not just, I believe that the trust is an active something you have to perform each time you're with your client. Once you bring in any sort of expertise, then that takes away some of your trust in the client knowing best.
Hello and welcome to the Towards Solution podcast, where creativity meets practical application. I'm Dion Singh.
And I'm Jason Pascoe. Together, we dive deep into the world of solution focus, exploring its transformative power across a variety of contexts.
Come join us each month as we engage in enlightening conversations with experts and practitioners who are applying solution focus in their unique environments. Whether you're looking to enhance your personal life, professional practice, or community projects, our discussions will provide you with valuable insights and actionable ideas.
Tune in to discover how you can implement solution-focused strategies and practices in your own context, unlocking new possibilities and creative solutions. Let's embark on this journey of exploration and innovation together. Subscribe now so you don't miss an episode of the Toward Solutions podcast.
Thanks so much for taking the time to join us for a bit of a chat. And by way of a little bit of backstory, you did a workshop in Australia, and at the time I was working for St. Luke's, and they got you out to do a workshop with us. Yeah, so I was fairly well steeped in strength-based practice, and your introduction was really the first time that I'd kind of really got a good idea of what solution focus was. So, and that was a real turning point. I've kind of gone on to do different things that I probably would have otherwise. So thank you for coming, and thank you for sharing, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Chris, what is it you love about the solutions focused approach?
I like it without the S. Yeah, I think the S was brought in by Mark McCargo and Paul Z. Jackson, really, to sort of distinguish it a little bit. Way back. So you can tell who's... And so it's got into the sort of coaching organisational world.
Well, you can tell who trained me.
So, that was just a little bit of marketing, I suppose, or distinguishing. So messes with the essence of the whole thing.
I think that's important. So let me ask the question again. What do you love about the solution-focused approach?
Well, I was just thinking about that yesterday. In fact, so I was having to write something. And when you say, well, since about 1987, and you're looking back that far, you think, God, why isn't the boat fed up with it? And I think it's because it's from the start we've had this commitment, which was part of Steve DeShazer's commitment, to continually think about what's necessary, what's not necessary, what are we doing that works. And so there's a constant, almost sometimes almost indiscernible movement. I was thinking, oh, what have I done? What have I done recently? What's changed over the past few years? And I realised the thing that's changed that I'm really pleased about is working at being neutral with my clients. So not having a view about what they should do tomorrow, not trying to encourage them, not trying to do anything that influences their choices, but simply to leave them at the end of a session with a sense of more choices, that the choice they take is theirs. That sounds simple, but it's very, very, very hard to do. So it's not something you can just do. It's something that's a sort of struggle through every session. To sort of try and keep out of the way of clients' lives. I was really pleased that someone noticed recently, compared me with someone else, and said I not that I didn't show emotion, but I didn't show any kind of encouragement and clients sort of reported things. I was interested in what they did, but there wasn't a sense of encouragement and wow in my voice. So I was pleased about that. Some people would be horrified. I was pleased.
Well, it's interesting because every so often before we do these, I drop some things in the chat, and because you joined after me, you probably can't see them. But one of the quotes that I put in there from your writing is from a client, and the client said, "I know that if we hadn't met, I would now be dead, but it is important to me that you know that you have not touched my life at all."
Yeah, fantastic, isn't it? What a thing. Yeah. Still gives me a little shiver. It's like,
I guess that's what it gave me when I read it. And that, so is that kind of what you're talking about?
I guess it is, though that was quite a long time ago, so I may have been, who knows, I might have been encouraging, I might have done lots of things that I try not to do now, but clearly that woman wasn't having any of it. Yeah, she took from it what, yeah, what we hope our clients do take from it, which is a sense of their own agency, their own achievement. And she was saying, whatever, what I've done, I did it. That was what's so brilliant about it.
Definitely something that I took away from that workshop that I attended with you was, for me, there was a difference in how people were scaling and really just using a scale, but only looking at, what's keeping the score where it is, what's working, and leaving it at that. It was something that I think, definitely stood out and something that I took away. And
Seems fail as a way to build the history that fits with a client's hoped for future. That's so I think sometimes solution focused people forget or imply that the past isn't important. The past is absolutely crucial to all of us. I mean, what would we do without our past? But I think we can use this scale to help people see other possible ways of viewing their past and ways with future hopes.
I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on what how do you think what's the simplest explanation of solution focus?
I wouldn't go if you have any explanation is going to turn you into an expert, so I wouldn't go there. I think there are obvious connections. Influences between that we have between each other, and that they're too complex and too idiosyncratic to have any real explanation for. Of course, that would be, I assume it works when a client's answer opens a door for them. There's no way we can make that happen. We just have to bang away with our questions and hope that it does. And so there's obviously an association between our questions or the client's answers and improvements in their lives. But it's not a scientific, not something that could be understood in a scientific way. And we can explain it in a way that leads you to do it differently. You see what I mean?
And would you, I guess, how would you explain it to a friend or a neighbor, someone who
As I said, look, I'll ask you questions. Hopefully, some of your answers will open doors. And hopefully, they will, but they might not. There's no way of knowing, other than statistically, the chances are that it will. It's more likely to open doors than it isn't. And the rest of it's a mystery.
I
Very cool.
love that. I love that because, Chris, you're the first person that hasn't answered the question. And I'm not saying you haven't answered it in, but like to say I wouldn't go there. Because what I'm really enjoying is the your respect and honor for the process. And even in my first question, just by adding an S, that distinction of standing out when we're actually having a conversation about not leaving a footprint. Yeah, so thank you. I love the way you answer that. Might work, might not work. Statistically, it does. And it's that invitation. Maybe you'd like to have a go.
And it's a good, it's a good gamble, if you like.
you want to hear. I love that. I love that because my 20-year-old son's just discovered poker at the local club where $25 buy-in, and he's like, I reckon I can come home, Dad, tonight. But this is probably a better gamble in a whole bunch of ways. No, that's awesome. So 1987. How did you even hear about the approach in 1987?
I got a couple of books to review from the. I was a family therapist back then. So, as a family therapist, Evan and Harvey, my two colleagues, we were family therapists, social worker, family therapists in quite a prestigious clinic working with pretty heavy duty child and child protection and adult mental health issues. And solution focus started to appear in the family therapy journals and 84, 85, 86, along with narrative. White, we're interested in both, and we decided we better teach ourselves both of these approaches so that we could add them to our family therapy teaching repertoire. And we so that was and I first came across it in a book. Still got it here somewhere. Might have it somewhere. I was to review two books. One was a book edited by Don Ephron, who was editor or became editor of the Journal of Systemic Therapies, and he'd written edited a book about different family therapists' journeys, and one of them was the Milwaukee team describing how they developed solution focus. It's a unique little paper describing the process of how the clinic worked. From its starting point in Stephen Insoo's dining room through to a world famous clinic. And in it also was a Bill O'Hanlon, how Bill O'Hanlon became a world famous brief therapist instead of killing himself. And along with that, I got Bill O'Hanlon's first book as well, so really shifting context. So that was my first taste. And then Bill O'Hanlon was in doing a workshop, his first workshop in Britain, which I heard about. So I went to see that. I went to like a 2-day workshop with 30 people with this unknown boy. That was an eye-opener, really. And then with Evan and Harvey, we decided we better teach ourselves these two things. We chose solution focus to start with and taught ourselves how to do it on a Wednesday afternoon, three clients. Initially with keys, two behind the screen, one with the client, initially with keys, and then 1988, Clues came out, and that became our Bible. And after a few months of doing that, we found we couldn't do anything else. So we didn't even get round to doing the narrative stuff. And we made a conscious decision when we realized we couldn't really continue to teach family therapy because it We just couldn't go along with it, along with the explanations as much as anything. We started doing little courses for local people on solution focus. We decided to take it out of the family therapy arena because we saw it as something that would have much wider application. Anybody could do it, you didn't have to be a hotshot, well-trained therapist to do it. And so we made a decision to take it outside the family therapy arena, which is why we're here, really, because those countries that didn't, like Spain, it's just stayed a minor element of family therapy, a subsection of a subsection, a subsection of strategic family therapy. So the same in Italy, though it's suddenly growing a bit more in Italy. It was a decision to take it out so that more people have access to it.
I find that a common theme. I find that as we talk to people, there's kind of this, you said it was an eye-opener, the workshop with Bill O'Hanlon and 20, 30 other people in there. And then almost this view of a wider horizon on this could work in so many places. What was the eye-opener piece for you in that workshop?
I sort of I mean, the workshop set me off doing some solution-focused things, which looked crazy but worked. I was at the time, one of my projects at the time was working with a family therapy colleague in a Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital, which is sort of the children's hospital in the UK, working with children who were, some of whom were suffering life-threatening physical symptoms due to warring parents. So parent families that had split up. And so we were working with the parents on trying to do this mediation, and which was pretty well the hardest work I'd ever done. Much harder than child protection stuff when you've got parents that have been fighting for years with their children in the middle. And then I came back from this Bill O'Hanlon conference full of jolly ho-ho positivity, and my colleague thought I'd gone crazy, but people started to change after one session. And then that coincided with Evan and Harvey wanting to look at solution-focused stuff, and I joined them. And then really getting hold of De Chaser stuff, I just felt I'd come home. This is what I've been striving for. I'd done lots of child protection teaching at university courses, social work courses, and one of my things there was about labeling. One of the exercises I would do it, have all the negative labels, and then have people work at what's the positive aspect of this? What's the bit of this behavior which you can endorse? So already was into some sort of crude strength-based work anyway, which was no one else was doing. And it was just my personal antipathy towards the labeling. Solution points felt like the language, the home I'd been looking for, and not just felt really just like a massive coming home.
Wow.
Awesome.
What does it feel like today?
Oh, a bit comfortable. More minimally furnished than it was originally. Given that we've what De Chaser did to traditional therapy, we've more or less done to solution-focused therapy, which is throw most of it out.
Hey, look, and I had a conversation with someone only a week or so ago. I was staying with Mark and Jenny in London in 2014. Jenny was heading off to a meeting, and it was about the conversation on their front porch was, this could be even better. But no one had even come up with Solution Focus 2.0 or anything like whatever people are labeling things as now. They just And it was that sense of keep looking for how we can do it better, help the client more, or in a simpler way.
We're, in a sense, the old farts of the approach now, and the next generation and generation after will be keeping it going in different ways. So, though I'm very wedded to what we do, I know that it's just a place on the track, really. Things will move on in all sorts of different ways, both making it more complex and going into developing into something else, and possibly making it even simpler.
Do you have any thoughts on, what is next?
No, because I don't think you can predict. I mean, obviously, there's lots of people doing all sorts of things alongside and with solution focus, adding bits, taking bits from here and there, some of which fit, most of which don't fit. Most things that are introduced don't fit because they are based on some expert knowledge. If you take the client being expert really seriously, then it also requires you to trust the client to know best. So we have to have a radical trust in our clients. So it's not just, oh, I believe that You've actually, trust is an active something you have to perform each time you're with a client. And once you bring in any sort of expertise, then that takes away some of your trust in the client knowing best. You have an idea of your own, which is going to be helpful to the client, and that breaks the trust. So for us, if you want to be truly solution focused, you really do have to trust the client, which means in the end, that's what makes sense of being neutral. Being neutral is one of the best ways you can trust the client. Is trying not to put our ideas in and what might be good for them to do, which is really hard because obviously, for every client we meet, we know exactly what they need to do in order to have a happy life.
I'm really interested in how you, so obviously, in a part of what you do is you teach solution focused. And how do you reconcile and balance the, teaching people and holding, obviously, as much as, you are an expert, you're heralded in the field as a knowledgeable person. How do you, is there a difference of how you kind of balance that relationship or that knowledge in that space?
Yeah, well, teaching, it's different teachings is a different process. The deal is different. You come to me because you want to learn something about what I do. So it's a craft. Solution focus, to me, it's a craft. It's something you can learn to do. And as you learn to do it, everything else falls into place around it. We never teach anything. Any of the traditional counseling skills, like, I don't know, empathy and whatever, all this stuff. We teach people how to ask questions, and the rest falls into place. If you ask questions in the way that we teach, then you'll have a very, very, very intense relationship with your clients while it's happening, and not be too bothered about them when it's not.
Can I go back to my can I re-ask my first question?
Yeah.
In how would you so how would you describe some the craft? What would you say? You said ask questions in a very particular way. What is the particular way in which you ask questions?
It's not so much the way you ask them, it's you can ask them whichever way you like, as long as you are asking solution focused questions. Which is why someone who's just done a 2-day course yesterday can have a conversation with a client today and create enormous, lead to enormous change in that client's life. Because as long as the questions are asked, as long as the client can answer them, because it's the answers that make the difference. So if you look at earlier tapes of mine or Harvey Evans, they're very clunky, incredibly clunky, but they work. Our first book, which we wrote before we met Steve DeShazer, it's got cases in it, incredibly clunky, but they work. So what we do is teach the questions in as simple a way as possible.
Can you tell us and I have a little bit of an idea, but for people listening who might not, what are you doing and how are you applying solution focus in your context?
For 30 years or more, we saw most of our clients for free because we wanted to work with the same clients of the people we taught. So any public sector professional, from children's, adults, drug and alcohol, whatever, we would see their clients free if they referred them. Particularly interesting clients where things were stuck. So we've stayed very committed to that. Now everything's online. Occasionally, I'll still get a call from a public sector, from a social work organization or mental health, saying, would I see somebody? Otherwise, we just see people on the grapevine. I've been seeing quite a few people recently with post-traumatic stress because that's got around. And I've been doing some workshops on post-traumatic stress at Solution Focus, who would deal with severe post-traumatic stress in a single session very often. Despite what the experts try and tell us. So that is another little mission of mine, is to counter this developing industry into trauma, which is trying to make it a very specialist subject, which means lots of people suffering from trauma won't get the help they need because it'll be too specialized, so there won't be people won't feel that they're competent to work with that issue. As in fact, cases where that's an issue and it never gets mentioned. I mean, like the woman who said, "You haven't touched my life," that's what she came with. Not that she said it, she said she knew that her past had created these problems, but if I talked about her past, she'd be out.
I saw research with Bolivian child protection workers in the Journal of Solution Focused Practice around vicarious resilience. So there's an interesting conversation that's developing or emerging around learning solution focused conversation. We know that having solution focused conversations not only moves and helps the people that you're having the conversation with. Research from last year suggests that it also decreases burnout in the people who are having the conversations with clients and gets a bounce in this idea of their own resilience.
We've Evan and Harvey have known this since the first Christmas party at a clinic that we were working in after we'd started our solution focused. So it was, we'd been 3 months into our project, teaching ourselves solution focused. Our wives met for the first time, and they said, "Oh, they all had noticed that we'd become easier to live with in the past 3 months." Not long after that, Peter Sunderman in Finland brought out a paper. I can't remember the title of it now, but in about 1990, 91, 92, something like that, comparing outcomes in two social work teams, one having had a 2 day solution focused. So there's no difference in outcome in relation to the work, but the social work team was happier and their clients were more satisfied. So that's been around for a long, long, long time. There's been the stuff that come out of the Canary Islands by again child protection and reduce burnout by oh, sorry, I forget names now. Can't remember the name of the guy, but been around in Tenerife for a long, long time, along with Mark Baerbach, who's one of the big researchers in solution focus. So no, I think it's a well-established fact that solution-focused professionals are happier. Even before that, when we were training, when we were teaching ourselves, we had a trainee social worker with us who learned solution focus with us. And she was a woman, she was a Bangladeshi woman employed to care for the local Bangladeshi community. There were 600 Bangladeshi families, mostly in abject poverty, and this one assistant social worker who could speak their language. And she said at the end of her placement with us, she said her husband wanted to thank us because he'd got his wife back. And she said, and it's true, before this, I used to go home and worry all night, worry all weekends about my clients. Now, when I say goodbye to my clients, I leave them and I get on with my own life. So, I mean, there's a little sort of anecdotes which are incredibly dramatic, really, when you think about it.
If we can listen to the people we're interacting with in a solution-focused way, and we have the questions to ask them so that they're talking about an outcome that they want, a preferred future, and we can help them find instances of that happening. Not only are they leaving the conversation differently, but so are your leaders. Rather than putting out fires, dealing with problems, feeling like the sandwich in the middle, and just even that anecdotal stuff for them to be going home and their partner saying, "It's nice to have you back."
It's a good evaluation.
So I think it's incredibly important that we don't make trauma this narrow, I'm using a trauma-informed response, which is X, Y, and Z. And I know that's going to be controversial, but I love what you're saying about that.
Calling it trauma. I mean, trauma's happening all the time. You find I'm a great one for leaving cupboard doors open, so I constantly get traumatized to the head as I bang my head on the full of lumps everywhere. And trauma is something that we mostly deal with. And I think that's the whole thing about the resilience of Adam and Carol, is that how we look after each other makes a big difference to how we deal with traumatic experiences. And that's goes back to any sort of trauma. One of the factors, I think, with between trauma that doesn't lead to post-traumatic stress is the support you get after the traumatic incident. And that's resilience is a relationship, I think, in that sense. So resilience in school, in any workplace, the way people support each other, the way people are interested in each other, makes a difference. That's where the resilience comes from, I think. And solution focus obviously has a way to do that.
Absolutely. Even in a corridor, a car park, or a playground conversation, it doesn't have to be long.
Absolutely.
I was actually just thinking about so most of what I do now is working with Aboriginal organisations in Australia. And I was having a discussion today actually about lateral violence. And anyway, that was where my mind went, which is where, a kind of a traumatized group of people tend to perpetrate that that on each other. And I was just thinking about the context, and I was talking to this person about solution focused practice and how it might be a really good fit in their organization. Do you have any thoughts on that as in that context?
From a just a purely very generalized solution focused approach, we'd be interested in not in the violence, but in the ways people have of looking after each other, which will also exist, which exists. They might be not as obvious because they're not being looked at, but I would be looking for exceptions, if you like. Going back to early solution focused stuff, I'd be looking for exceptions, because these will be also groups of people who look after each other. That would be a start for me. Documenting care.
Great thought.
Stepping back a little bit in our conversation, Chris, you said that you and Evan and Harvey saw so many possibilities for using the solution-focused approach, and that's been something that's helped not only broaden it but at last in terms of what you do. When you were talking about, in Spain, it got stuck in a subset of a subset of a subset, and it sounds like you and Evan and Harvey tried it therapeutically in lots of different contexts. And from my understanding, just reading the history of what Steve and Insoo had done and looking at transcripts and videos and stripping back the language to only questions that would move the client to where the client said they wanted to go, you're broadening across not just staying in one area and doing it in child protection or in these a particular area. You think that helped you make it simpler?
Well, it made us realize something that Steve DeShazer had said anyway, is that the problem's irrelevant. So in a sense, whether you're seeing a heroin, homeless heroin user, or a head teacher sort of struggling with burnout, it's the same process. So in that sense, we just knew it could, there was no distinction, the problem didn't matter. What mattered was somebody wanted something to be different. So in that sense, and so the difference it made to us was more of a business difference, if you like, because it meant we could train anybody and we'd have examples at work. And that was partly why we decided to do most of our therapy free, so that we could continue to have examples of any group that came for training. we'd have examples, usually video examples of work with their sorts of clients. So it was, it had a an economic element to it as well.
That's fair.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's one of the it's one of the things where, you know, a solution focused approach, you know, can get, do well in business. There's you know, they got the saying, you know, it's not a very good business approach because, you know, you see somebody once and then you know they don't need to keep coming
Yeah,
back. But
absolutely.
it broadening made sense. Very very good. One of the things, Chris, that we were really keen on in doing this podcast was that people who listen to it could, you know, learn something and then go away and try it and, you know, and practice something. Is there something that you could, you know, teach us, teach people that are listening that they could go away and try?
The simplest thing to try is find a friend or something to do. It would be a what we call a project scale, where you scale a project that you're involved in. A project being anything that you decided to embark on at some point in the past, and you hope to achieve, finish at some point in the future. So it could be work related, domestic related, socially related. It could be writing a book, it could be learning an instrument, it could be setting up a new service, it could be your dissertation, whatever, something that somebody's engaged in. Just a project scale. Zero is when you first decided to embark on it. 10 is you've completed it satisfactorily. Where are you on the scale? 25 things that you've done to put you at this point on the scale. Five small signs, that's five things that you might notice if you moved up one point. Not how, never mind how you're going to move up one point, just five things that you might notice if you did. So it's description of what's done, and mainly description of what's already been done, and a little bit of description of what might be. That's very, very effective little interviewing sequence.
Absolutely.
Anybody could do it. Anybody could do it because it's in by numbers, really. To ask, make sure you get the 25 things that somebody's done.
Why 25?
All right, 35. I think it's because you have to start. 25 is a lot if you've never done it before. Whereas now 100 is perfectly possible once you realize that there's no end.
I was down in Sydney and at an appointment with my son, and he's got a pub that he likes to go to afterwards. We're sitting at the bar to the waitress, and she's doing psychology at university. And anyway, we were talking about solution focused brief therapy. I said, "Have you been exposed to that at all? What is this solution focused brief therapy stuff?" And I said, "Well, can I give you an example?" And she's like, "Oh, yeah." And she's pouring beers for people, and she's coming back over. And I said, "Just think about something you'd like to get better at." I said, "All right." I said, "Don't tell me. Don't tell me. Just think about something you'd like to get better at." And I said, 10 is as good as you could hope to be, and one's the opposite of that. I just want you to come up with a list of five things that would describe a 10. Don't tell me." She's pours some more beers and comes back, and I said, "Now I want you to think of five more things." And she comes back, and I said, "On that scale, where do you think you'd be right now today? Don't tell me. I'm going to go to the bathroom, and when I come back, I want you to have seven things that get you between a one to that are working in your favor that get you up to that number." So I went to the bathroom. She came back. She poured some more beers, and she says, "Yeah, I've got seven." I said, "Can you think of three more, but don't tell me?" And she said, "All right." She nodded. She said, "Yeah, I've got three more." I said, "All I'd like you to do now is just think about three tiny signs that you might be one point higher, and who you'd most like to notice that you'd made at one point higher, and think about what they might notice." And she came back, she's gone, "Yeah." And I said, So is something clearer to you now? She said, yeah, I know what I'm going to do next. And I said, and I still don't even know what we're talking about. I love it because that's such a powerful example of scaling technique and exactly what you just described to us, Chris.
That's so helpful. You won't believe how helpful that is to me because I'm next week or a week off, sometime soon anyway, there's the 24,
Oh,
SF24
yeah.
World Conference. I'm doing something on there. And I was thinking, could I do a mass interview?
You can.
And
I've done it. I've done it online.
you've
Yeah.
just convinced me. I won't do it with a scale. I had something else in
Yeah.
mind to do it. But yeah, let's just think less and do
I'd love to hear how it goes. I would love to hear how that goes because that's what I think is magic to me about this. I don't have to know. So in wrapping up, Chris, because we don't want to keep you too long, and we really, really appreciate your generosity in with your time. You said, and I'll use your words, getting on a bit, you and Harvey and Evan. What would you say to the next generation of practitioners?
Would say, I'm not sure I'd say anything. Some people are following closer to us and trying to keep it simple. Some people just seeing connections all around and blowing their minds with that. I think that's, enjoy it. What I'd say is enjoy it. Continue to enjoy it.
Thanks again for taking the time.
Well,
And
pleasure. Very happy. Very happy to. Well, nice to see you both as well. Have
it's great to meet you, Chris. I really appreciate your time.
an enjoyable day.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for joining us on the Towards Solutions podcast. We hope today's insights inspire you to apply solution focus in your life and projects. Whether you're applying these strategies in your personal life, professional practice, or community projects, we're excited to see the impact you create.
If you found this episode helpful, please share it with others who might benefit from our discussions. Your support helps us to reach more people and continue to bring you quality content. Stay tuned for more enlightening conversations and make sure you subscribe and let's continue this journey towards solutions together.